Hello, and welcome to this Targeted Oncology podcast, Navigating Treatment Decisions in Relapsed NPM1 Mutant Acute Myeloid Leukemia, Practical Insights for Clinical Care. I'm Dr. Gabe Manis from Stanford U University, where I'm an associate professor of medicine, and I am pleased to be joined today by my esteemed colleague, Dr. Gail Robos. Gail, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure, thanks very much. Happy to be here. My name is Gail Robos. I'm a professor of medicine and director of the leukemia program at Weill Cornell Medicine and the New York Presbyterian Hospital in New York City, where we do not have any of the palm trees that you do in Stanford.
Well, in this episode, we will focus on the real-world management of relapsed or refractory NPM1 mutant acute myeloid leukemia. Our discussion will cover how the treatment landscape is evolving, how clinicians are approaching therapy selection, and what practical considerations such as safety monitoring, outpatient management, and patient preferences factor into our decision-making. So with that intro, let's go ahead and dive in. And I'll toss the first question to you, Gail. How, in your mind, has the treatment landscape for relapsed refractory NPM1 mutant AML evolved over the last few years?
I think I'll broaden for a minute to just say relapse refractory AML because you and I have lived in the business long enough to know that the relapse refractory AML space was actually referred to pretty unanimously as the place where drug development or where drugs went to die. It was very, very challenging to get anything to work for patients with relapsed or refractory AML. And then we started an avalanche of drug approvals from 2017 to now, which really have completely altered the treatment of AML in ways that we didn't even dare to dream about, forget 20 years ago, even 10. In the relapse refractory space, what we started seeing was that molecularly targeted therapies actually were having single agent complete responses. And this was a stunning blow open of the space with things like IDH1 and IDH2 inhibitors and FLT3 inhibitors. And now we are talking about the NPM1 space, where you have a specific target, which, when hit correctly with a medication, all of a sudden was giving us these single agent responses. And when that drug development sort of pathway, molecularly driven therapies was happening, we also had the advent of venetoclax, which is not hitting a specific mutation, but rather the target of BCL2. So broadly speaking, BCL2 inhibition, the addition of venetoclax first to HMAs, to hypomethylating agents, blew open the space for treating older patients. But then we really started seeing that venetoclax made everything better. So both in the relapse setting and in the upfront setting, there started to be a new era of combination therapies of putting novel individual well-targeted oral agents together. So that takes us full circle back to your question on relapse refractory NPM1. NPM1 was not even thought to be a druggable target, and yet now we are dealing with both two FDA approvals and several new drugs coming down the pike. The treatment landscape is wide open, but the treatment decision making, which I think we're going to talk about in the rest of this session, has become actually quite complicated because NPM1 and other mutations don't necessarily hang out in isolation. They co-occur, they happen together. And now the real question is, how do we take all of these great new drugs and put them all together to really start curing patients, not just getting a few more into remission or a few more months of therapy, but driving cure.
Yeah, I will just add that in all the talks that I give about relapse refractory AML, there's a study I like to highlight, which I believe you led from many years ago, where it was drug X versus investigator's choice of, you could pick anything. There was no standard of care. Choose your acronym, whether it be FLAG or MEC or, any of these things that included, heavy duty chemotherapy. And I don't know how many hundreds of patients were enrolled across the world, but at the end of the day, the curves were entirely overlapping. And that's sort of where we had been in AML just up until the last few years. And so, really excited to talk about this. And With that, maybe we dive into specifically NPM1 mutated AML. When you see a patient with relapsed NPM1 mutated AML, what are you thinking about in terms of the impact of co-mutations on the risk and the response to subsequent therapies?
So it's a nuanced question, I would say, because the first thing is in anything that is, that we're doing as a teaching session. So the first important thing is to actually do the reassessment of the mutational profile of the patient. And it is definitely the case that depending on what they started out with, there are certain mutations which stay present, and there are others that disappear at the time of relapse or that have changed their friends and family at the time of relapse in such a way that the mutational profile of the patient is different at the time of relapse from at the time of initial assessment. I will just jump in and say one thing which is so important for the entire rest of our discussion, which is that the mutational profiling and the panels that you send either locally or to commercial labs for analyzing what is the mutational landscape of a patient is not the same as what you are doing for MRD or measurable residual disease testing later. So I'm going to throw that in right now, even though you didn't ask me, and we'll go back to it later. But basically, it is definitely the case that the co-mutational profile is primarily essential for driving the initial, hopefully curative management plan for the patient. At the time of relapse, you do want to know what is available, but the problem is that we actually don't have a tremendous amount of good data in sequencing or combining in the relapse setting when patients have multiple targets. For example, FLT3, IDH1 can occur with NPM1 mutations. And the questions that we're frequently asked is, well, do you just throw everything together? Do you put them all together? We have multiple agents for each one. How do you put them together? It's beyond the scope of this to kind of go over every permutation because there are a lot of them. But what I would say is what the patient has been treated with initially, what is the friends and family mutational landscape at the time of relapse, and also what is the available therapy for that patient is what drives my decision making. What did they get before? What do they have currently in terms of their residual mutations? And importantly, what do they have access to? Because in the relapse, in the co-mutated setting, I am definitely always going to lean to a clinical trial because we would all love to do what we're at, know what we're actually doing in this space. But absent that, and most patients don't have access to a clinical trial, what we need to know is what medication do they have access to? And there might be a real difference if somebody has, for example, an NPM1 and a FLT3 mutation, can they get both drugs? And does the doctor know how to use both drugs together? It's really, really complicated. And I would say call a friend is a good thing to do if you're trying to manage a relapse refractory patient with two concomitant, even though they're FDA approved, if you have, for example, a concomitant FLT3 inhibitor and an NPM1 directed agent, it's complicated to manage these patients. I'm hoping you agree with that, but please say if I misspoke.
Certainly. And I definitely want to pick your brain about how you pick therapy depending on those co-mutations. I do want to just step back. We are focusing on relapse refractory NPM1 mutated AML, but it's important for the people listening who don't manage a lot of AML to understand that maybe the most important thing is to not get into the situation of relapse refractory AML. And the friends and family that coexist with NPM1 play a huge part in predicting which patients will relapse. And we think of NPM1 mutated AML as a favorable risk AML, chemotherapy responsive, but about half of patients will go on to relapse after initial intensive induction. And the co-mutational profile at the time of diagnosis can help tailor therapy to try and avoid being in the situation where we are dealing with relapse refractory NPM1 mutated AML. Because as we know, once the disease has come back, it is a different beast and it is no longer a good risk entity. So, with that being said, you have a patient with NPM1 mutated AML, unfortunately relapses after, let's say, standard induction chemotherapy. What sort of testing at relapse, and you kind of spoke about this, but what specific mutations do you test for? Do you test for all of them? And then let's say you get back multiple mutations that are potentially targetable. What do you do in terms of choosing your next therapy?
I think it's important to underscore that quote unquote good risk is simply not a term in relapsed AML, right? There's no such thing as a good relapsed AML, and I think you brought that up very importantly. We tend to, in the relapse setting, we tend to send a very broad panel, not necessarily because the, 80 or so or even 100 genes that come back on a panel, it's true that we don't know what to do with most of them. However, in most both commercial and academic lab settings at the moment, the way that these things are priced, it actually isn't an advantage to pick and choose genes, which is, I'm saying this not because I'm an expert in cost measures. I'm absolutely not. But it's important to realize that in the past, there used to be this pick and choose approach. And now, honestly, you want to send broadly because you might pick up something that that you were not expecting. What I tend to do is the following. If the patient has a relapse that is in a co-mutated setting, let's say with an NPM1 and a FLT3, if there is a FLT3 in the picture that is an ITD, that tends to drive the relapse. That tends to be a more proliferative type of disease. And I am very likely to be getting a FLT3 inhibitor on board. Now, playing in terms of, for example, combining a FLT3 inhibitor with a menin inhibitor and so forth, I'm hesitating to admit what I do because I don't. This is like in the, the TV shows where they say, like, don't do this at home, and they have a person, I don't know, jumping off a building, holding three babies or something. Like, don't do this at home because it's actually very difficult to combine medications. I currently am treating a patient who actually has a concomitant FLT3 ITD along with an IDH2. These combinations do happen. And I will say that outside of clinical trials, I think most of the time in most of my patients who are off study, I am trying to sequence rather than put everything together because most of the time you actually get into trouble if you drop bombs on people with three or four different inhibitors at the same time. That said, I would say that since this is an NPM1 talk, it is very important to know also the variant allele frequency and the representation of mutations that might be appearing in a co-mutated setting. Because if you have a little tiny variant allele fraction of one and a much bigger clone of the other, it doesn't mean that the little tiny one isn't important. And there might be a whack-a-mole type of situation where you press down on the big one and then the little guy jumps up, but it might help you in sequencing. And I do think that combining all of these medications off study is a challenge. That said, we now know that we have multi-agent regimens in the relapse refractory setting that includes NPM1 that are actually quite successful. So we have two in the moment in the United States FDA approved therapies for NPM1 mutations. Both of those can be used individually, but we already know that in the relapse refractory setting, when they're combined, for example, with an HMA and venetoclax background, the relapse, remission rates are generally much higher, and actually the co-mutated patients are likely to be better served with that type of a background. So rather than necessarily picking two individual inhibitors, there is a lot of argument, I would say, to be made that patients with a relapse disease who have had intensive chemotherapy before are likely to get an NPM1 a menin inhibitor in combination with an HMA and venetoclax. The bigger challenge is the older patients who might already have had 23 cycles of an HMA and venetoclax and are now relapsing with an NPM1 with or without something else. In those scenarios, I'm much more likely to use the targeted inhibitors that have not been used perhaps before in that patient. And the general theme is if they've had it already and a lot of it, giving them more usually doesn't work. If they've had intensive therapy already, I almost never am reusing intensive therapy. I'm switching to HMA-Ven. There are some exceptions to that for patients who've had a particularly long remission after intensive therapy. Occasionally, in a very explosionary situation with a young patient, I might use a CLAG or a FLAG or a CLIA-based type of super intensive salvage. Those regimens have IPAPing salvage rates in the right setting for the right patient. But in general, look what you did before and try to do something different going around the second time. And try, if you can, to not use the inhibitors as single agents, because whether it's a FLT3, an IDH, or a menin inhibitor, the response rates are better if you are combining them. My last comment before you tell me why all of this is wrong is that the goals of therapy do matter, because if what you're trying to do is tootle along somebody who's 88 or 90 and just give them count recovery and have a nice quality of life outside of the hospital, you're not trying to get that patient into a transplant or into more definitive therapy. There is no reason most of the time to bomb that patient with multiple agents. And I have been very successful in going small rather than going big in those patients and taking my 6 months at a time with an individual agent. If, however, you are talking about a patient who is a younger patient who has a transplant on deck, either because they were trying not to be transplanted out of the gate, they had an NPM1 mutation, they were MRD negative, we were trying not to transplant them, but now they're going to a transplant, then you are going to likely go in with a menin inhibitor in combination with other agents, get them clear, and get them into either a first or potentially a second transplant if they're young enough. What do you think of all that? Horrible.
I think it's great. I have little to quibble about. Before we dive into, I think the specifics of the FDA-approved menin inhibitors, and I do want to get your take on the approvals that came in the last year or so. I did want to highlight one thing that you mentioned, which is that, just because a patient did or did not have an NPM1 mutation, a FLT3 mutation, an IDH mutation at diagnosis, does not mean that those will or will not be there at the time of relapse. FLT3 is notorious for coming and going. NPM1 tends to stick around, but can be lost in about 5 to 10% of patients at the time of relapse. And so it really is important at a bare minimum to test for the mutations that we have targeted agents for. But as you pointed out, I think it is very helpful and often just the same cost to do a full assessment of the mutational landscape. But with that said, for patients, let's say, who have received an intensive induction and have gone on to relapse, or let's say, maybe make it even easier. Patients that have received Ven-HMA, they're not fit for intensive chemotherapy, have an NPM1 mutation, and then relapse. Can you talk a little bit about the data that led to the approval of the two menin inhibitors, revumenib and ziftomenib?
And I think that as we launch into that specific scenario, it's important to distinguish between morphological relapse disease in somebody who was kind of hanging out, doing fine, fully in remission, undetectable, and then boom, relapses, versus a patient who is being monitored, for example, using a PCR test and having rising transcript levels of NPM1. So they're relapsing, they're molecularly relapsing, but they may not be, quote unquote, blowing up in your face. And I think that here too, the testing for this is so important because the repeated molecular testing with broad gene panels of patients who were fine, but now they're relapsing, that's different. That's looking for what came back, what was there originally, what's new. The subtlety of the patients who are being followed with, for example, FLT3 and NPM1 with these high sensitivity tests is opening up a new area of the definition of relapse And it's complicated because the IDH1 and IDH2 mutated patients may have trickling along levels of disease that may even not predict relapse, whereas our guys with the NPM1 have it. So to your point, you've got an older patient hanging out on HMA-VEN. HMA-VEN is great for NPM1 mutated patients. It actually is sitting on the top end of the curve. There are patients who are living well beyond 24 months in remission with that regimen. We weren't even having anybody, older patients alive with HMAs alone for periods like 2 years. So if you have one of those patients who is starting to relapse after having had venetoclax, I think that drives you into the land of, oh, wow, now we have this drug, the non-druggable target of NPM1 is now druggable. So the biology of that is, is a fascinating one that you have KMT2A or NPM1 binding with menin, which is a scaffold protein, and all of this results in upregulation and expression of Hox genes and the HOX/MEIS pathway. This drives leukemogenesis. You block that critical interaction with a menin inhibitor, and it fixes the disease. So this is fantastic. This is our sort of modeling that works in other diseases like CML. It works in a molecularly driven pathway. You have this critical interaction that is blocked with a menin inhibitor, and you have a patient, for example, like who you're describing, who now all of a sudden has a rising NPM1 level. You give them a menin inhibitor. Revumenib was initially approved. Again, I would say that the KMT2A story there is even more impressive than the NPM1 story. I mean, KMT2A, for example, in the pediatric setting, I mean, horrendous outcomes in tiny babies with this awful subset of disease now getting turned around by a biologically and mechanistically driven thing. I mean, incredible. So revumenib and ziftomenib in the single agent relapse setting having, depending on how you look, about 25% remission rates. These are sometimes MRD negative remissions. They are well tolerated. Menin inhibitors, like IDH inhibitors, like FLT3 inhibitors, you got to watch out for differentiation syndrome. Doctors need to learn about this. They know about it already for APL, but they're not, it's sort of all the same for FLT3, for IDH, for NPM1. You have to watch very carefully for differentiation syndrome, which, by the way, is not only in the first couple of weeks of therapy. This can happen over time. You have to watch for QT interactions. Revumenib has a stronger QT signal than the other ones do. And a lot of these patients are older and they're on 10 other drugs that can prolong the QT. Not to mention, here you have an all-oral regimen. So you're going to give someone who's 85, give them a little Levaquin, give them a little ondansetron, give them a menin inhibitor, and tell them to see you in 2 weeks. No. Absolutely not. It might be all oral therapy, but it is complicated initial management with 2 and 3 times a week monitoring, possibly in the hospital, depending on how far they live from your center. And I would say that, again, you're looking for single agent responses in that, I don't know, 25% zone and much higher if you combine with other treatments. If you have a patient who's had multiple cycles of HMA-VEN who is a much older patient, I tend to start out with the single agent and see what happens. But you could make a case, depending on how they're doing, for just throwing on the menin inhibitor, given that the triplet responses are higher.
Yeah, a lot to digest there. Like you said, response rates, around 25% in terms of composite remission. What I'm struck by, and what I think adds support to your argument for potentially combining these agents, is that, despite relatively good MRD negativity rates, the survival was still only in the 4 to 6 month range. So, these patients may get into response, they may clear MRD, but these are not durable responses. And so, I certainly in my practice, whenever I can, think about, combining them with other agents, especially for the patients that are more robust and potentially transplant bound. But I agree, a lot of these patients are in their 80s, their 90s. And so starting single agent, watching safety.
I guess
I'm
I would
struck.
just ask you, Gabe, what do you think of, like, because this is not what was done in the trial, and I mean, I'm on some of these trials, so I there's no question that triplets and even quadruplets, the responses are so high. What I wonder about, and some of the relapse patients, especially the more frail ones, is that might we, and I do try this, get them on like stable footing with the single agent so that you know how's it going, how are your first few weeks going, everything perfect, and then jump in. I think that's a question, just a clinical question that we all have that's incredibly difficult to study in a trial. But you just wonder sometimes with if you have someone who's in a relatively stable position, might you be able to get through the first even couple of weeks, keep the storm quiet, and then come in with the others. I don't know if you've ever tried that or if you think it's worth it.
No, certainly, especially because, many of the patients we see really are frail, and, the goal of therapy in the palliative setting is to, maintain quality of life, improve quality of life. I say, probably first and foremost beyond extending quantity of life. And so, I think a measured approach really is the way to go in these patients. I wanted to talk a second about the QT prolongation. And, I think on these trials, I don't think I've ever gotten more protocol deviations than on these trials because they exclude any drug that has even a whiff of QT prolongation. And, I'm curious sort of what your anecdotal experience has been in the real world setting, using these drugs, monitoring QT. How do you do it? How frequently are you bringing patients in to monitor QT?
So, I mean, look, I think it's a definitely it's a regulatory and safety bugaboo issue for obvious reasons in that it can cause very severe things like death if you have significant QT prolongation. That said, knock on wood, and I don't want to jinx myself, this has not been a major clinical problem for me at all. And actually, if I take myself back in time, not as far back as L-cytarabine, which is the manuscript you mentioned earlier, but I pulled together the data on QT management for arsenic trioxide in patients with APL, and it was a very stunning, stunning learning experience for me to understand things like the Bazette correction versus Fredericia correction versus some of the subtleties of QT management. And when you have excellent therapies, the point is get the therapy in. Arsenic trioxide cures people with APL. These are very important meds that we're talking about here, menin inhibitors and others for our AML patients. So we need to get the drugs in. So what I do is I definitely look at a baseline EKG, and I am definitely worried about people who already are in trouble out of the gate and who I know are on multiple prolonging agents. That said, I do have people concomitantly on these drugs, posaconazole, Levaquin, all kinds of things. I think for a lot of practices, it's very hard to get an EKG. It's just not that easy to send a patient for an EKG. If you're in a private oncology office in an academic center, I can get an EKG in the lobby in 2 minutes. So I tend to, if I am worried about the patient's baseline number, I do tend to follow it. If I have choices, or if I have a patient who's on antiarrhythmics or other things, and I'm going to have a choice between menin inhibitors, it's true. For example, ziftomenib currently has less of a signal than revumenib. It might be a problem. It might be a distinguishing thing for a patient who actually has this as an issue. I think the most important thing is I have to speak out of both sides of my mouth that on the one hand, it's not a huge clinical problem, and I don't want patients to not get their drug. On the other hand, I'm not dismissing in any way as a safety concern because there is a concern, and I do check and make sure that patients don't have significant prolongation or a family history of SOD beforehand so that I don't get myself into trouble and mess up my own record of not having to have this as a problem. So it's both a problem and not a problem. It's not a problem if you are careful.
On that note, just to spend, a couple more minutes on the safety. I think as AML doctors, we all have had experience with differentiation syndrome, whether it be in the APL setting with FLT3 inhibitors, IDH inhibitors. I think there was a sense early on as we were studying menin inhibitors that this differentiation syndrome might be different, and that Our understanding of how to manage it, how to recognize it, maybe has changed throughout this process. And I'm curious if you could maybe just share some pearls about, for the practicing physician who doesn't see differentiation syndrome all the time, what are you looking for when you start these menin inhibitors, and what is your sort of immediate action when you start to see some of these warning signs?
Yeah, so I think AML patients who come in hot and sick might have pneumonia. They might have an elevated white count from an infection. They might have an elevated white count because their disease is exploding. They might have an elevated white count because somebody just gave them prednisone for a COPD exacerbation, which is what I had last week, that all of a sudden the white count is flying, everybody is in a panic, and okay, well, it was the whatever prednisone or Medrol dose pack. So there are lots of different things that cause an angry looking elevated white blood cell count, perhaps with increased blasts. Patients can be fluid overloaded because they just got a bunch of transfusions, or they just got IV fluids for an infection. So when you tell a doctor that a rapidly rising white blood cell count in the setting of pleural or pericardial effusions, weight gain, shortness of breath, cough, look out for all of this. The doctor may want to choke you because this might be happening for lots of reasons in an AML patient that do or do not have to do with your new menin inhibitor. However, those are the things that you are looking for. And basically, it is very much easier to go ahead and start BID dexamethasone than to start wondering. If you are doing a lot of wondering about, is this patient differentiating or not? Get some steroids on board. You're not going to have steroids on board forever. You are unlikely to dramatically worsen an infection with a couple of doses while you're trying to figure things out. But the most important thing is not to be definitive that, oh, this disease, I'm on day three, my white count is going up, my blasts are going up, this drug isn't working. That would be the wrong conclusion. You don't want to stop the drug. You may want to use Lasix, Hydrea, steroids. Most of the time, unless there is true pandemonium in a grade four kind of a setting, most of the time you can actually treat. Most of the time, it is very clear that anything that is differentiation syndrome is mitigated by combination therapy, for example, either with chemo or with HMA-VEN. That usually calms down the process. And I think the point is to remember to think about it, not blow off the, well, this drug isn't working, and stop the drug on day three, because there would never be a determination that the drug isn't working on day three. And also to make very sure that you are treating things simultaneously as you would for an AML patient. If you think there's an infection, treat that. If you think the white count's going up, fix that. You can get some Hydrea in at the same time. If you are thinking about steroids while you're thinking, just start them because it probably means you need them, and see if you can calm everything down in a few days. And the other reminder is only that sometimes these can sneak back up on you a few weeks later. It's not common, but it can happen. So you don't want to completely put it out of your mind for that first month.
Great. I do want to get to talk about sort of the future of NPM1 mutated AML and sort of what you see in the next few years. But before that, I just wanted to ask about a case and bridging to transplant. So let's say we have a 45-year-old who has NPM1 mutated AML, gets 7+3, gets consolidation, 18 months later, relapses with NPM1 mutated AML, doesn't have anything else targetable. What is your approach to bridging that patient to transplant?
I think that there's okay, so there's bridge to transplant as a concept of cleaning up residual disease and then moving right into a transplant. And then there's the case that you've talked about here, which is somebody that we were trying to cure upfront with intensive chemotherapy, but that didn't work. And now they relapsed, and now they need to get back into remission to a transplant. And I do both of these things. For the patient that you're talking about, who's a year and a half out, I think this patient would have probably a very good chance of going back into remission with a triplet type of combination with an HMA plus Ven. This a patient hadn't gotten any other exposure, had chemotherapy before. You can probably put him back into chemotherapy with intensive chemo plus either venetoclax or a menin inhibitor. And I'll just throw it out there that that gets a lot of discussion, whether the quote unquote big chemotherapy salvage choices, things like FLAG or CLIA in combination with either venetoclax or a menin inhibitor, which one is better? I don't know. There are lots of ways to get this patient back into remission, but I would be very focused on an easy, smooth path of an HMA ven in combination with a menin inhibitor. I'm getting the transplant ready. And yeah, it's my favorite if he goes in MRD negative to the transplant, because we don't have a beautiful data set, like, for example, for the Morpho trial, where we know that if you are peritransplant detectable for FLT3, either before or after, then 2 years of the FLT3 inhibitor gilteritinib could help you from a survival perspective. We think that could be true with NPM1-2. Maybe that's true, that if you go into the transplant NPM1 detectable, or if you come out of it NPM1 detectable, maybe a menin inhibitor fits in the same way. But we don't know that. That hasn't been studied yet, unless it was published an hour before this call and I didn't see it. But we don't have those data yet. So my favorite thing in somebody like this is to have him be MRD negative before going into that transplant. That said, it takes some time with an HMA ven and a menin inhibitor approach. That might be a couple of cycles, and I wouldn't necessarily delay that patient's transplant while you are chasing tiny, tiny amounts of MRD. I think that actually usually turns into a mistake, because it's not necessarily the case that you can have a linear or either even partially linear reduction of MRD with ongoing cycles. That could be a resistant clone that's left there, and then you're on cycle three or four of something, your transplant is sitting waiting around, and you could get into trouble. Is your approach similar to that or different?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always an interesting discussion whether to do intensive chemo with ven, whether to do lower intensity therapy, HMA ven based, throw in a menin inhibitor, do you use menin with ven, menin instead of ven? I think these are all things that are relatively unknown, but I would agree that in that setting, the patient is likely to be salvaged easily, relatively easily, with whichever of those choices you choose. It's a question of what kind of shape will they be in when they get to transplant? How quickly can the transplant be set up? So I think, incorporating patient-specific factors is really important in that decision. But in the last minute or two, I just wanted to get your thoughts. What are you excited about in the NPM1 space looking ahead 2, 3, 5 years from now?
So I think we are in an amazing moment of simultaneously increasing and decreasing the role of allogeneic stem cell transplant in AML, which is a weird sentence. So let me say what I mean. What I want to have happen is what happened for CML, what happened for pH positive ALL, that for the molecularly targetable and measurable diseases where we have really good MRD markers and where we have the ability to offer salvage chemotherapy in the setting of relapse, I would love to not allo transplant NPM1 mutated patients up front. I think that would be fantastic if we could push the numbers. So if you look at the chemotherapy, the intense, not 7 and 3, but the real chemotherapy, things like FLAG-IDA Go or FLAG-IDA Ven, the NCRI or MD Anderson protocols that really have very, very, very high rates of MRD negative ongoing remission into 3 years, maybe 80% at this point. If we can keep chipping away at those 20% of patients, and if we can cure people out of the gate, either with a lot of therapy or with easier treatments that are HMA ven based, I would love to have NPM1 patients get cured without a transplant and not be on therapy forever, because that doesn't work either, to be on treatment forever. At the same time, I think it's very clear from the early results of the PARADIGM trial, which notably excluded NPM1 patients, by the way, that a lot more patients with AML overall are probably going to be getting less intensive inductions and then going on to transplant for cure. So for the NPM1 space in general, I think we should be absolutely shooting for cure, both in the younger and the older patients. I want to have the opportunity for time-limited therapy if it exists, but menin inhibitors are sufficiently, they're well tolerated enough that you could imagine being on them forever, like you would have, let's say in CML, some patients are on a BCR-ABL inhibitor forever, but I doubt it. I think there's going to be resistance that comes up. And I think that we should be focused on the cure package for NPM1. Probably with incorporation of a menin inhibitor, probably with some incorporation of ongoing therapy if patients don't get intensive chemo upfront, and getting into the mainstream so that it is absolutely essential and easy to get in mainstream clinical practices in anybody's office, the excellent high sensitivity MRD monitoring for these patients so that they can get the right test, be followed for a period of time and then declared cured would be fantastic.
Wonderful. I like the concept of the cure package, both for the younger and the older patients, because I do think we are starting to see there are some data out there that there are patients who are older with NPM1 mutated AML who may be able to come off therapy and never relapse. And so understanding that better, I think, is exciting. I think the next generation of menin inhibitors will be exciting drugs that are more effective and safer, figuring out resistance, understanding which mutations emerge while patients are on menin inhibitors that lead to such a short duration of response. All of these things really exciting. And I look forward to talking about these with you at meetings to come.
Sounds
All
fantastic.
right.
Thank you
Thanks
so
a
much
lot.
for the time.
Thank you, Dr. Robles.
And thank you.